Welcome to the Detroit Football Network podcast. We got a full boat today. Got Will Birchfield and Stoney joining me. And look, I am rested and recovered after a red-eye flight back from AZ. Took a couple days, but the Lions are not quite in as good a shape. Lost Marcus Davenport, lost Derek Barnes for an indeterminate amount of time, and at least for this upcoming game, Frank Ragnow will not be available. Don't know if that's it, but you know that's certainly three big losses. And so let me just start by throwing this to you guys. Who of those three do you think is the biggest loss, the most difficult one to overcome?
I think it's Ragnow, because not just his blocking ability as a center, but as you guys know, I mean, he calls out the protections. He does all the little things that people really don't know about. And yes, Glasgow has, you know, experience playing center. There's no doubt about it. It's not that just bringing some guy off the street. But Ragnow is as good as Sewell is, right? You guys have to agree that Ragnow is the heart and soul of that O-line, right?
For sure.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that Frank Ragnow is the extension of Ben Johnson's brains on the field. And they talk about him so much as kind of a secret weapon of this offense. And he resists that term because it's too glamorous and glorifying for him. But he really is the code cracker for this offense. He is the one, along with Jared Goff, who is figuring out and diagnosing the defense, what kind of fronts, pressures, blitzes they're sending, how to account for those, and how to help Jared stay upright. But I think that the duration of the injury, which doesn't seem like it'll be more than a week or two, is the reason that I don't have much worry about Glasgow stepping in there. I think Davenport is a huge loss, only because he seemed to have a really positive effect on the defensive line and Aiden Hutchinson in particular in the two games that he played. Now, it helps that Pascal is a similar physical profile. I think he can do many of the same things that Davenport did. I just wonder if he can do them with as much violence and as much impact. Davenport was a powerful edge setter, and everyone kept talking about that in training camp, and it showed up in the first two games, and was one of many reasons why Hutchinson was off to such a great start. I don't think Hutchinson will suddenly dry up in the sack department, but I think they're going to have a hard time replacing that edge setting presence that Davenport brought them.
Well, yeah. Hutch had a good game when Davenport didn't play. So
he was just fine.
He was okay. By the way, Dan Campbell today, talking about Frank Ragnow, I thought it was like a dog. We have to put Frank Ragnow down. I mean,
yeah, they're taking him out to pasture.
Yeah.
That is not going to be good for bringing in free agents in the past, is when they realize that euthanization is the choice when you suffer an injury. But, nothing against Derek Barnes. He's playing phenomenally. I think we've talked about that a little bit. I've certainly written about it a bunch. But, you know, I'm going to kind of lean with Will here in terms of long term. You know, I as much as I want to believe in Josh Pascal, through 2 years, he has given me no reason to believe yet. The production just hasn't been there. I think I'm more reassured by Levi Onwuzurike's play. You know, that's kind of where they went in that Tampa Bay game with a 315-pound edge, which is, quite a sight to see. But every time you turn on the tape with this guy right now, it's just unbelievable dominance. Like, it's kind of shocking and jarring, really. I don't exactly know what that's going to look like, because we don't know how good to go Aleem McNeil will be. You might need to lean on Onwuzurike a little bit more, in the middle of the defense. But I just think Davenport ultimately is going to be a huge loss. I didn't know what to expect with that guy when he got here, but from the day he stepped on the practice field in training camp, I mean, it was very apparent that he was exactly the piece they were looking for opposite Hutchinson. And when that pocket's crushed and the quarterback has nowhere to go, you know, that's where Hutchinson's thriving.
You guys are talking long term. I know it's still a few weeks away, maybe 6 weeks. I don't have the exact date with the trade deadline. If they don't get great production from Pascal or Wingo or anybody else, he resisted last year when Chase Young was available. Do you think this year, if they're really good like they have been, that Brad Holmes will bite the bullet and say, you know what, this is the year to go for it. I will find somebody.
It's a really good question. You know, they went out and they got Peoples Jones at the trade deadline, so they're not you know, completely adverse to taking a chance on bringing a guy in at the right cost. You know, I think there was a reluctance with Chase Young just because of the you know, some of the other stuff that goes mm-hmm. along with him, whether it's injury history or, you know, accusations of maybe not playing within schemes, whatever it was. And, you know, as well as anybody, I mean, there are just certain positions that cost more at the trade deadline. You know, if you're going to go out there and get a Montez Sweat-esque player, you're going to pay. And often those guys are at the end of contracts, they're looking for extensions. And I know the Lions are in really good cap shape right now, but, you know, eventually all of the big contracts they've signed and still have to sign are going to eat up that space. And so I don't know what Brad Holmes is willing to pay for a rental, but to get a pass rusher with impact possibility, you're probably looking at a day two pick at minimum.
I wouldn't be surprised if he's more open to the idea this year, only because it was such a clear need in the second half of that Niners game in the playoffs last year. And I couldn't help but wonder to myself during that second half if he was thinking about the effect that another pass rusher would have had. They were one or two plays away on defense from winning that game. And I do wonder, as the deadline approaches, if he puts himself back in his own shoes in late January in San Francisco on a Sunday evening, watching the season slip away because they just couldn't make enough of a push up front. And that alone might compel him to go get a player this year. But it, as J-Raj points out, they also didn't have Levi Onwuzurike last year. And there's a good chance that he's the pass rusher that they've been missing. And I'm not even going to bring up James Houston's name, except that I just did, because yeah. that's the other natural pass rusher on the roster. Obviously, he's a long way from making a consistent impact, but the Lions really trust their internal depth. And I think they would just as happily turn to a player like, say, Isaac Okwu, as they would go spend a day two pick or more on a pass rusher who might be here for 6, 7, 8 games and then depart in free agency. Just judging the way they've done things, they don't view this as a championship window in that it's closing. They think that their window, because of the way they draft and develop players, will remain open as long as they continue attacking the roster the way they have for the first 3 years. So if they don't think the price is right, I'm not sure they'll take the plunge unless Brad Holmes thinks back to last playoffs and says, all right, maybe the time's now.
And the fact that you're right about Houston and the fact that Wingo is actually playing a lot, you know, they think more of him than James Houston, obviously. Not completely the same position, but.
Yeah, let's quickly have the Houston discussion because, I mean, it comes up a lot and rightfully so. You know, look, sacks are at a premium in this league, and for him to go out and have the second half of a rookie season that he had was jaw-dropping. And you really thought, okay, you know, they've solved a hole. You know, maybe he won't be a 10 or 15 sack a year guy, but, you know, really could be you know, have a situational impact for a long time here. But the fact of the matter is he doesn't rush the passer the way they like to rush the passer here. He is more speed. He's one of the most bendiest edge rusher I've ever mm-hmm. seen. And when you rush that way, you create escape lanes. And for all the people that complain about quarterbacks running on you, I mean, James Houston is the type of player quarterbacks will run on because you just create this really wide gap between the defensive tackle and the edge rusher. And so stylistically, he doesn't fit. And at this point, you know, I question why he's on the roster. And I have this hypothesis, if you will, that the Lions know that in a better scheme for him, he probably could be impactful. And I don't know if they want to deal with the criticism that might come with that, if you will.
Yeah, or potentially have to deal with that if he ends up on a roster that they encounter down the line. I mean, if you're basically releasing a player who could be a 8, 9, 10 sack pass rusher, you run the risk of having to face that player down the line. And to add to your theory, maybe that's part of it. But you could tell, and you can tell, anytime we hear from Dan Campbell and he's asked about James Houston, like this week on the radio, there was an audible, And then he began to answer the question. I think he has said as much as he can say about Houston. And when Dan Campbell has real praise to distribute to a player, he doesn't hold back. And the most he could say about James Houston this week was, yeah, he's still working, man. He's working. Still working. And if that's all that he has to say about you, I just don't know how you are pushing to play on Sundays.
I like that we got a little dog in us today. little bonus guest. Is that you, Sony?
No, yeah, that's Rosie, and she's going to be a pain in the butt. So,
welcome, Rosie.
Yes, I might have to put her outside on a leash in a second.
Yeah, I don't think we need to go much over the Tampa game. We kind of cover that, obviously, our Tampa Arizona game. You know, we cover that coming out of the game. But I just wonder, you know, if you've had a day, two, three to process it, was there anything that's kind of been lingering for you guys from that game that, you know, you really liked or, you know, still concerns you about this team going forward?
Well, what I liked is somebody who had a really good rookie year and was not good last year. And so far this year, and he did it again against Arizona, Kirby Joseph really has stepped up his game back to where we thought it was going to be last year. And for a variety of reasons, wasn't. I thought that was really pretty important, especially last week.
Will, do you have anything to add on Kirby Joseph and why he might be playing well?
I mean, obviously, it's because he's playing next to the best defensive player on this roster in Brian Branch. So there's no other explanation. It's as simple as that. For me, it was not just the production on the ground, but the versatility on the ground and the way they got their offensive linemen in space a lot. I thought I was really impressed with a number of blocks that Graham Glasgow had down the field. I loved the fact that on that, I think it was a 3rd and 12 on a touchdown drive in the first half, that they ran the ball with Gibbs up the middle, kind of a delayed handoff, and Glasgow and Zeitler both got downfield and made blocks. It seemed like they were, you know, we talk a lot about the offensive line mauling and the way that they can move a line of scrimmage, but they're also athletic. That's part of what makes this run game so multiple. And I like the fact that they had their, especially interior linemen, downfield. There was one play that I want to point out from Glasgow, who obviously is going to be a focal point now shifting into center, where he was holding off an offensive lineman and Buda Baker came on a blitz and Glasgow like cold shouldered him and maintained his block and allowed, I think, Montgomery to gain 6 or 7 yards. So I thought that the run game obviously bounced back and the offensive line showed kind of the totality of its ability.
I've been meaning to ask an offensive lineman this week. Maybe I'll throw it out to Ben Johnson. I can't imagine I'm going to get an answer, but you talk about the versatility of the offensive line, and they are almost a 50-50 gap scheme, zone scheme, run team, and that gives you a lot of flexibility on all the things you can do. But against Arizona, for whatever reason, I mean, it was mostly zone runs. I don't know if it's the matchups they identified and why that worked, but it did. I mean, that worked for them in that game, and I'm just curious what goes into the thought process of choosing whether to attack a team with zone runs or gap runs.
You know what? It's probably a negative, but not from that game, because as Will knows, and you know, kind of, Justin, I kind of am a nitpicker. the great play, the hook and ladder, whatever you want to call it, it did cross my mind a day later, say, God, why didn't they run that play against Tampa down the at the end of the game? They probably would have scored.
I think that was what they were trying to run with very different personnel, but I'm pretty sure that pass on fourth down to Tom Kennedy was about to be flipped to Khalif Raymond.
Okay.
And we just never got to see it develop because, you know, just it was a bad pass by Goff. There's no other way to put it. It kind of was a fitting end to a rough performance, but
slightly different personnel running it through.
State you're not expecting it, right? So, I mean, that's the beauty of it. I'd like to take that bigger. Like, why don't we see more hook and ladders in the NFL? Because, like, I know there's a risk element to flipping the ball, but man, they feel like they're successful. It's no different than misdirections on so many other types of plays. And so there it is, Ben. Just why don't you throw it in there once every other week? I think we would all really
for our own entertainment purposes, nothing else.
Hey, do you think the league is, you know, it's such a copycat league, and I think other teams have been more aggressive on fourth down following Dan Campbell's lead. But if you, the first three weeks of the season, It seems teams are running the ball a lot more like the Lions did. They're not passing. The quarterback play hasn't been as really good. Do you think that the Lions' success has, I don't know, been the template for some teams right now, or is it just a three-week deal and we'll see what happens later on?
Probably a little of column A and a little column B, right? Mm-hmm. Like I think, you know, still the heart and soul of football is toughness and physicality and kind of what that's what the Lions have built themselves on. They also have, as we've talked about, you know, the sports car in the garage to use it whenever they need with Jameson and Gibbs, but running the ball is kind of their bread and butter and being physical up front. And so I'm not that surprised. I think what you're also seeing, obviously, is you could read up on it in a lot of places, but defenses are doing a lot more to take away the deep ball, and they're forcing these quick passes to the flats, and they're kind of boring. I don't know how long this is going to last into the season before offensive coordinators start kind of cracking the code, but passing numbers, air yards per attempt is a big one, is just down across the league, and it's making for some boring football, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I would agree. I think you're seeing a lot of two deep safety looks, and you know, if things go as Anzalone likes to say, in and out of vogue around the NFL, and it seems like right now that's in vogue, just eliminating the deep part of the field and forcing teams to have long drives and maybe hoping that especially early in the season, over the course of a 12 or 13 play drive, they make a mistake and they give you the ball. I think teams are refusing to allow those three play 80 yard drives capped off by a 65 yard touchdown through the air. So, I mean, look, there's zigs and there's zags, and eventually the offenses will adjust, but that's stuck out to me through three games.
Yeah. In the Cardinals game, you know, Goff was looking for J-Mo. He was, he would do a play action handoff. And those are the ones where Williams is running past the deep man in the secondary, and Goff turns around from the play fake. And what does he see? He sees four deep across in quarters. Like, they're back, you know, 20, 30 yards and taking that away. And so I thought Goff played a really good game, and it was kind of a boring workmanlike game, but that's what he had to play because they were taking away the deep shot all game. And that's what it was. I did want to say that my takeaway was that they're a Terrion Arnold development away from being a really, really good defense. Like, you know, I look at him right now and I say, it's the weak link. It's not an unexpected weak link. You know, he's a rookie cornerback, and he's taking his lumps. I actually thought there were some promising plays there in the second half.
He's getting close, I think.
He covers really, really well. He's sticky, right? And if that's your calling card right now, is you aren't giving up separation, you're right. Close is the right word. He started making some plays in the second half, and I think you're going to slowly see that percentage of plays made versus given up tick up as the year goes on. And I think once that connects, like, the weaknesses in this defense are really hard to find, which is kind of a crazy thing to say after the last couple years. It used to be, you know, pick your poison with the weaknesses, but they're close. We should probably hit a break. When we come back, I had a nice interview with Seattle Times reporter Bob Condotta. He has been covering the team since 2013, so we've been about on the beat about the same amount of time. He's covered couple more Super Bowls than me, but you know, I'm working on catching up. So stick with us, and we'll have that interview on the way back. All right, and we're back. I spoke yesterday with Bob Condotta of the Seattle Times. He's been covering the Seahawks since 2013, and we talked about the upcoming matchup with a few injury questions lingering on both sides. Correct me if I'm wrong, Bob, but you've been doing this beat since 2013. Is that correct?
Yeah. Hopped on at a good time, yeah, right in time for them to win the Super Bowl. So, sort of been all. I don't want to say it's been all downhill since then, obviously, because they've still been pretty good the whole time. But first year they win the only Super Bowl in franchise history. So that was sort of fun. But yeah, this is now year 12.
Well, based on, you know, extrapolating out how a season might turn out, 3-0, you might be covering another Super Bowl. And so, look, these Seahawks are off to a hot start with new coach Mike McDonald. And I'm just curious, how are you separating the team's early success against maybe the caliber of competition? You know, the first 3 weeks, they've, you know, seen Denver, New England, a toolless Dolphins team. So, you know, run into some teams with QB issues, to say the least.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's impossible not to separate what their record is from who they play. And you know, I think everybody sort of views it This is going to be the first real big test they've had, is going to Detroit Monday. You know, a healthy team, a good team, obviously coming off a really good season, coming off a good win down at Arizona. So, I think Mike McDonald, he looks like he's going to be a good head coach probably for a really long time. I'm not sure though that this team wouldn't be 3-0 if Pete Carroll were the coach as well. Who they played. They've had by far the best quarterback on the field in all three of those games with Geno Smith and the way he's played. That's what most NFL games come down to, is who's the better quarterback or which quarterback is playing a lot better on that day. And Seattle's had a discernible edge at quarterback in all three of those games. And that's probably the defense has played well. Statistically, it's played really well. Again, Detroit will be a really good gauge of exactly where the defense is. But, going against the quarterbacks they did, that Skylar Thompson got hurt midway through that game anyway. And so they were, they ended the game with, Miami did with a 13 quarterback out there, who they just signed off the practice squad and Tim Boyle. So, this will be a completely different thing Monday.
I think you just gave some Lions fans a little PTSD with the Tim Boyle reference there, but they'll get over. In fact, I believe Tim started the game in 2021 where
he did.
Seattle dropped 51 on him. So I'm sure you've made the adjustment at this point going through camp, but I think it's still going to be jarring for some of us to see somebody other than Pete on the sidelines. And look, McDonald's known around these parts. He had the brief run as Michigan's defensive coordinator, did a really good job in that role, before going back to Baltimore and continuing that success. But he's overhauled the coaching staff there. He's got what I believe are two first-time NFL coordinators. And so, what can you tell us about maybe some of the schematic changes that are revealing themselves here on both sides of the ball?
Yeah, well, I think the organization overhauled the coaching staff. When they fired Pete, you're not gonna get rid of the head coach and then keep everybody, who he brought in. And John Schneider, who's the GM, he made it clear on the day that they made the coaching change that he was sort of now in charge of picking the coaching staff as well. And so, I think a lot of this was, hiring McDonald, and they brought in Ryan Grubb from the University of Washington as the offensive coordinator. I think that was kind of John's masterwork from the start, was that, hire a head coach who's got a defensive background and get him in. And then we're going to, I think they targeted a couple of different guys for the offensive coordinator. I think Brian Grubb was who they wanted all along if they could get him. And so, I think that was kind of John Schneider's plan there, but yeah. Defensively it's interesting. McDonald, his whole MO that he came here with and that we're seeing, it's not one easily definable defense. Like, they're in a 4-3 all the time or something like that. They do an awful lot they do a lot more sort of personnel adjusting than they did under Pete Carroll. That was a little bit, especially in the glory days of the Legion of Boom, that was kind of Pete Carroll's thing. That they had a game 1 year during that I think they only played like 13 guys on defense because they were able to just, they didn't have to sub in much. They didn't do a lot of sub packages. But you had Richard Sherman and Earl Thomas and Cam Chancellor. You're leaving those guys out there on the field all the time, and you're not moving. You're not bringing in 5 or 6 DBs necessarily if you don't need to. And so so that was kind of Pete's preferred way of doing it. McDonald's sort of MO is kind of each week's a different chess match, and maybe this week you got to play. They did a lot of six defensive back stuff last week against Miami, which made sense given what Miami does offensively with the receivers they have, and they're playing a lot of guys, rolling a lot of guys through, running a lot of different stuff, kind of based on who they're playing. So, it looks a little bit different every week, but there are obviously some core principles. In general, it's sort of a 3-4, with three interior guys and getting the two guys out on the edge and trying to really rush the passer that way. And they've been pretty good at doing that so far. There's a lot of different pressure metrics and stuff like that out there, but they're among, the Seahawks so far, or I think by any of them, are sort of top five or so in terms of the pressure they're getting on the quarterback and things like that. And so he's really found a way to get that done. Offensively, I don't know that it looks, I really don't know that it looks a ton different. Just if you just look at it, what they're doing offensively, they still feature most of the same guys. The offense basically came back intact. They did make some personnel moves on defense, but it's the same three receivers, the same couple of running backs, the same quarterback, much the same offensive line that they've had for a while now. So I don't know that it looks a ton different schematically, but Ryan Grubb is sort of known for really being able to dial up some plays here and there that really work. And, they got that last week with a 71-yard touchdown pass to DK Metcalf that sort of broke the game open You know, that's sort of his MO, is being able to each week kind of try to pick at the opponent a little bit, find a spot to really sort of try to dial up a few plays that they think can kind of work and get some explosives. And, you know, so far, both the New England and the Miami game, they had long touchdown passes to DK sort of early in the game that helped, you know, turn the game their way.
I think one of my favorite parts of football is the chess match. And, you know, I like what you're saying about the personnel groupings and being able to mix and match, because, you know, that's exactly what you're going to see from Detroit's offense, too, is the ability to mix, match, schematic versatility. And look, McDonald wrecked Ben Johnson's system last year in Baltimore. So I think there's a multiple measures of vengeance that the Lions are looking for in this game and make for a compelling matchup. Look, there's a lot of new pieces on that defense, including Leonard Williams, because he popped in after the Lions matchup last year via trade. Looks like there's a lot of changes up the middle with the safeties and the linebackers. No more Bobby Wagner or Jamal Adams or Quandre Diggs. And so how's this new look defense kind of coming together with these new pieces?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, Leonard Williams was one of the big, you know, swings it kind of took midway through last year when it's easy to forget, again, you know, for a team that fired its coach, essentially. They were in first place on the NFC West going into November last year. And that was when they made the trade for Leonard Williams, kind of hoping maybe he could put him over the top. And instead, they kind of went in a tailspin the rest of the season, and the 49ers zoomed past them, and the Seahawks didn't even end up making the playoffs. But, yeah, having him, Byron Murphy, their first-round pick, both those guys are sort of injury questions, so we don't know. And today, this being a Monday night game, they don't have to do an injury report today, so we're not going to know what they've done in practice today. But they didn't put them on IR, so that speaks to that they don't think it's a significant injury. Otherwise, they would, you know, you could put those guys on IR and just designate them to return, but they'd have to miss four games. But they're not even doing that with them, so that speaks to, you know, they don't think these are injuries that are going to keep them out too long. But both those guys got hurt the first half last week. Leonard Williams only played 5 plays against Miami. So he's got a rib injury. Byron Murphy's got a hamstring, but those two guys have made a big difference. You know, the first two games anyway, when they were playing a lot, you know, on the interior of the defensive line. And so that's a big part of the kind of the revamping the defense, was putting those two guys up there. When they do a three man, a sort of their base interior defensive line with a nose tackle and two ends, you know, Leonard Williams and Byron Murphy and the Jonathan Hankins, who's new as well. You know, they're typically, along with Jaron Reed, who's the holdover, you know, that's three of the four guys, kind of new from this time a year ago anyway. And, yeah, the linebacking core is completely different. They brought in Terrell Dodson, free agent from Buffalo, to be the new middle linebacker and take Bobby Wagner's spot. And Bobby Wagner's, you know, Hall of Famer, one of the best defensive players probably in NFL history. But I think the Seahawks felt like the age has started to catch up to him a little bit speed-wise, and especially sort of going sideline to sideline. And, you know, Dodson's a quick, athletic guy. There's no doubt about it. And so, you know, I think that's really shown up so far. I think they feel like they're probably a little bit faster maybe overall in the back seven this year. You know, having like Reek Wolin being healthy as well. That's, you know, he was never really healthy last year. And, I think that caught up to him some too. But this year he is, and he's playing really well. He's sort of back to playing at the, you know, the Pro Bowl level he had as a rookie in 2022. And then adding Devin Witherspoon to it also. Last year in Detroit, I think, was Witherspoon's first game ever, if I recall right, because he had kind of had some injuries during camp and didn't play the opener. But, you know, getting him kind of fully integrated into things, I think they're just a lot better in the secondary. But, yeah, the safety spot looks a lot different with no Quandre and Jamal Adams and Julian Love, who they signed last year, was sort of the third safety. But they sort of, you know, made him kind of the leader of the safety group. They re-signed him to a big extension before the year. You know, they were really happy with sort of his overall play. Brought in Rayshon Jenkins, another veteran guy who's been around a lot. And he's a really good run defender. You know, they play him a lot, kind of in the box, close to the line, as sort of your prototypical strong safety guy. And, you know, so far, you know, that's they've done pretty well with that. You know, that said, they gave up 185 rushing yards to the Patriots. And even knowing, you know, going into that game that was what they wanted to stop, knowing that the Patriots don't really have a great passing game, not just because it's Jacoby Brissett, but, you know, that's not a very good core of receivers that the Patriots have either. They were kind of lucky to win that Patriot game the way it worked out. So, you know, if they had lost that game, things would look a little different right now, but they did. They were able to make the plays down the stretch to pull that out in overtime and make everything look really good right now.
I had missed the Williams injury out of that. I had peeked at your injury report from the week before, and it was preposterously long. You know, Lions fans are obviously got frustrations with some of the injuries here, but it's everywhere, it feels like, in the NFL. You know, and in terms of the DBs being faster, I think that's going to, you know, scare Lions fans a little bit, because those last two games, two of the biggest plays have been pick sixes, you know, really tied turners in both those contests. And so nobody wants to hear that the secondary is better on this side of the ball. I do have another, you know, injury one, and I know we're recording this Wednesday early evening here in Detroit time, but, you know, Kenneth Walker did get back to practice late last week in a limited capacity. I don't know what kind of optimism, you know, you would be able to express at this point in the week, but whether he plays or not, what is the difference between Seattle's offense when he's on the field or off?
Yeah, I you know, my hunch is he'll play. I think they are hoping he will, and I think they pointed to this game a little bit. Not that you're looking ahead, but I think they felt like with Miami's situation, you can maybe win that game, you know, with what you have, and then in a game when maybe you're going to need to score a lot more points, hope you're back to full health in the backfield. So I sort of think Kenneth Walker will be able to play in that game, and I'm sure he wants to, kind of going back to Detroit. Zach Charbonnet had a really good, especially a fourth quarter. I think he finished with 91 yards, which was a career high. He had 42 on sort of their last drive that kind of put the game away. Despite sort of how feeble Miami was in that game, they still sort of had a shot there. It was 17-3, and the Seahawks had to make a goal line stand kind of late. And then after they made that, they were able to drive 98 yards for a touchdown, and much of that was just ready. Charbonnet, I think, was pretty, you know, it felt pretty obvious, like Miami defense at that point was just sort of like waving the white flag, but still, you know, it looked good at the time driving down there. And so, you know, Charbonnet is sort of a really good, you know, between the tackles guy, tough to bring down. But, you know, he's also probably the best receiving running back that they have. He had a really nice 30-yard touchdown down the sideline, touchdown catch against Denver. You know, so he's a really good sort of all-around back and who they can use a lot in third down situations. And I think ideally when they have Walker, that's sort of what Charbonnet's role would be. Walker just, you know, he just really makes people miss. He just kind of has an uncanny ability to keep the plays alive, finding yards where maybe they don't look like they're there. You know, the one knock on him at times has been that he tries to do that too much, and that sometimes he's bouncing stuff with, you know, just kind of go between the tackles to get the yards that are there instead of potentially, you know, if it doesn't work, you know, maybe you turn it into a 5-yard loss or something. But he's really crafty, and he had a great camp, and he looked really good in the opener. You know, had a really nice 23-yard touchdown run that kind of helped break the Denver game open week one. And then he got hurt late in the game, so we haven't seen him since early fourth quarter of the Denver game. But, you know, he was out there a little bit Friday. You know, we saw him all week, kind of before practice, doing sprints and doing some side-to-side stuff. And, you know, so it looks like one of those things that, you know, I think they want to make sure it doesn't get worse. He had a similar injury last year that cost him a couple games as well. So, you know, but again, having the long week to Monday and all that, you know, by that point it would be like 15 days since he last played. So, or maybe 22, maybe I'm like, yeah, I guess it'd be 22 days from September 8th to September 30th. So, you know, I think they're, my hunch would be that he'll be back.
And then you mentioned, you know, Witherspoon making his debut, and it wasn't a debut, but Smith Najigba was still kind of getting his NFL legs under him when the Lions and Seahawks played last year. And so, you know, it's the second season. He's got some of that experience that's so valuable to young players. Now, are we seeing any shift in kind of the target share, the dynamics with Seattle's, you know, receivers?
I mean, I don't think you're seeing anything that they want to do. And again, as we talked earlier, it's a completely different coaching staff. So it's hard to say they're doing this differently last year than, you know what I mean? Cause it's not like you don't have, these guys weren't the guys making the decisions last year on target share or whatever. I mean, this is just, these guys just took over this team and they're just doing what they do. Smith and Jigba had a really good game in week two against New England, had 12 catches and 100 and something yards. But I think some of that was just kind of a function of the way that game went. They were struggling to run the ball in that game, and you know, second half it became pretty obvious they just kind of shifted to, you know, we're just going to throw a ton of short passes here and try to get the ball to guys in space, and that really fits Smith and Jigba's game. Last week against Miami was a little bit, the whole offense was just a slog last. I would urge nobody to read anything into any of the numbers from the Miami game, because if you watched it, they had a ton of penalties. I think they had 8 penalties on offense, and they kept having all these third and longs. They just kept the whole second and third quarters, they just kept getting pushed back. And I think they had 6 third downs that were 10 yards or longer during that period. They didn't pick up any of them. I mean, it was just kind of a mess of about a 40-minute period there offensively. So I think he only had 3 catches, but again, nobody was doing much of anything for basically from when DK got the pass to put it up, make it 17-3 until that very last drive when they put it away. The offense didn't do anything. So it was just kind of, you know, it was just kind of between, a couple of tip passes that were picked off and some things like that. It was just kind of a mess of the day offensively.
And we'll close here with the offensive line. Feels like maybe this is an oversimplification of things, but, you know, Seattle's been kind of chasing some stability up front for a while and maybe not putting the resources in to get that stability. But, you know, now they've drafted Charles Cross in the first round, and you pick up a guard in Bradford last year. And then this year they kind of go out and round it out with a couple quality veterans in Connor Williams and a guy people will know here in former Lions first rounder, Laken Tomlinson. And so the talent level seems a lot better on paper. Obviously, Cross was out last year for the Lions game. They were starting a couple UDFAs, if I remember correctly. Chemistry takes time with the offensive line, but what have you seen early on from this group? Do you see, the offseason vision coming together?
Yeah, I mean, in their defense, I mean, they've spent a first, 2/3, and a 4th on the offensive line in the past 3 drafts. I mean, they have tried to do some things there. Charles Cross, left tackle, is the one position that's not a question. I mean, he's looked really good. I think he gave him 1 sack last week on sort of a play that just got away from him. But other than that, he's been really good. And then Connor Williams, yeah, they signed him in August. He's coming off an ACL tear, and he hadn't done anything football wise since December until basically the last week of the preseason here when he started practicing a little bit, but he didn't play in the preseason. So it's fair to say their offensive line is a work in progress. But I think ideally, and then the right tackle spot, they're already basically starting their second string right tackle, George Pham, with Abraham Lucas, 3rd round pick 3 years ago, who started basically every game as a rookie, and it looked like, you know, him and Lucas were going to be bookend tackles for a long time, or him and Cross, I mean. But Lucas is dealing with a knee injury. He had surgery in January. He's not back. They signed George Pham to sort of be fill in at that spot, and then he got hurt in the opener and is now on IR. So they're down to a guy named Stone Forsythe, who's in his 4th year, and he did not play very well in the Denver game. And we were talking to him today, and he basically admitted it. You know, that just didn't, you know, had just kind of first game of the year, just didn't feel like he played very well. But they feel like he's played pretty well the last 2 weeks, so I think they feel like the tackle spots are fine. The one big question for him has been right guard, where Anthony Bradford, who I think he's a Michigan guy, grew up in Michigan, but ended up going to LSU. But he started and he played every snap last week, but they rotated them a little bit with a guy named Christian Haynes, their 3rd round pick, in the New England game. Then last week they just felt like Bradford had a good week of practice and sort of deserved it. But he's got 6 penalties already this year, which I think is the second most of any player in the NFL. He's given up a couple sacks as well. He gave up 1 of the sacks in the Denver game that resulted in a safety. He gave up, that was a holding penalty, but he got called for a holding penalty that resulted in a safety in the Denver game. So that's been a struggle. It's been their right guard spot. They kind of said again this week, they're throwing it open to competition. My hunch would be both those guys will play. But the other 4 spots are pretty set. And yeah, Laken Tomlinson has been, he's been okay. I don't know that he's been I think their issue has been pass protection. I think they've been decent run blocking in the interior. I think the pass blocking in the interior has been a little bit more of a struggle at times. That said, their run game numbers haven't been great. So, I think a lot of the pass stuff has been Geno Smith, I think, has been bailing him out a lot as well with his ability to kind of read the rush and get rid of the ball quickly and stuff like that. So it'll be interesting to see, going on the road against a good defense in a tough situation like this. I think on both sides of the ball, this is going to be their best test of the season.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really good matchup up front. Detroit's got some moving pieces up there after losing defensive end Marcus Davenport this week to an injury. Aleem McNeil's got a shoulder. It's Wednesday. We don't know what his status looks like, but You know, Levi Onwuzurike has been, you know, a Washington guy, you know, well, has been given teams hell now that his back's right. And I don't think anybody needs to sing Aiden Hutchinson's praises anymore. I mean, he is just off to a terrorizing start. And so, you know, I think that's going to be a matchup that could really define this game. Well, Bob, as usual, these things go longer than the commitment I ask for. And so I'm very grateful for your time. You can find Bob's work on Twitter, obviously, at Bcondotta, Condotta, on X, Twitter, whatever you're calling it these days. And obviously, the heart and soul of what he does is at SeattleTimes.com. Bob, I really appreciate you taking the time for joining me, and sure. Look forward to catching up with you when you get here in Detroit.
Sure. Yeah. Anytime. Thank you.
That was Bob Condotta of the Seattle Times, and you know, he had a lot of good things to say about the matchup. Look, this is a Seattle team that just there's no other way to say it. They seem to have Detroit's number. You know, going back obviously well before Dan Campbell arrived, but you know, all 3 years that Dan Campbell's been here, they've lost this team, and I don't think anybody's complaining about that first year with Tim Boyle starting. That was expected. But the last 2 years, really, really competitive games.
They've lost 8 out of the last 9 to them.
Oh man!
Yes.
When did they?
And then those games in 2005 really have a bearing on the games. Yeah. on Monday night.
I know. I'm just making a point. The last time they beat them was 2012, 28-24.
2012.
Yeah.
Ugh.
I'll check the box score for you, Justin. Your memory.
I was covering the team, but I don't know if I want to remember that year.
The Lions touchdown passes
here
were
we go.
Here we got 3 from Stafford, obviously. But they were to Ryan Broyles.
Perfect.
And 2 to Titus Young.
What a day for Titus Young
was 20 seconds left in the game.
Who said Martin Mayhew could not draft in the second round? Look at that. Just all the second rounders thriving in a day. Can't beat Seattle without him. Yeah. Look, this team has the last 2 games have been phenomenal. I mean, a 48-45 game was just a circus of enjoyment. And there was no Amon-Ra in that game, which is even crazier. Last year, overtime, 10-point comeback in the fourth quarter, squandered. Goff had a pick 6 in both those games that I think were critical. But
and Campbell went conservative in that game, too.
Uh-oh.
People out. Remember that?
If he goes conservative, he gets criticized by Stoney.
Yeah, no,
if he gets aggressive,
people freaked out because he kind of, you know, milked the clock rather than go for it, and they got the field goal to send the game in overtime.
Well, this is a very different Seattle team, and maybe not necessarily on the personal front, but it's just going to be weird. Pete Carroll's not there, and they've got Mike McDonald. So yes. I think, you know, people around here are familiar with him from his 1 year stint at Michigan, where, look, they were really good defensively that year. I guess I had not realized it, but they were top 10. Michigan had its best finish in the polls and since the national championship year in 97. And so, you know, he was a really big part in kind of getting that turnaround going defensively for this team, which I think still, you know, you can hear echoes of it in their current defense. Great defenses in Baltimore. The Lions ran into that buzzsaw last year as well. And so, plenty of new personnel pieces. What do you like about the way that, you know, the Lions offense might match up with this defense this year?
Well, I think, obviously Ragnow being hurt hurts the Lions, but the fact that their guys are out definitely helps the Lions as well. Though I think they should be able to run the ball, but you never know what McDonald's going to come up with. What is, I don't know if you want to say worrisome, is their secondary. I mean, Witherspoon is terrific. Woolen is really good.
So good.
Yes. And so, you know, that's the deal there.
Yeah, and Jenkins is a really good safety. Comes down, crashes down hard, makes a lot of plays against the run. I think he's pretty solid in coverage too. This is a really good unit, and Mike McDonald has been dialing up the pressures early on this season. I know there's different sites that measure these, but last I checked on Pro Football Reference, they were 2nd, I believe, in pressures and pressure rate, obviously the number one passing defense, and they've got a couple outside linebacking pass rushers in Mofe and Hall, who three sacks each that can really bring it. And they're not going to shy away from that on Monday night. They're going to come in there and try and bring the heat on the Lions offensive line without its leader, its general on the field and try and make Jared Goff as uncomfortable as possible. And they have the pieces to do it. So it'll be interesting to see, how they align up front. I would imagine we'll see a Wasika step in, at guard as Glasgow shifts to center, but you can bet full well that the Seahawks and McDonald will target that weakness in the offensive line and try and expose it early in that game and often.
What I think is really interesting with the pressure numbers and the sack rates that you're mentioning is they're not blitzing. I mean their blitz rate is towards the bottom of the league. So they don't have to be aggressive. They have such good coverage in the back end that they can drop seven on most plays. And that's where we've seen the Lions and Goff kind of struggle here when, you know, there's so much noise in the back end. And so I think that's gonna be really fascinating. I'm really excited. I like good on good matchups. That's what, you know, excites me as a fan of the game, right? And so St. Brown and Witherspoon should be outstanding. You know, that is a second year corner. It's a guy that the Lions really liked. Many would tell you that's who they wanted in the draft. He plays slot first, moves to the outside when they're not in nickel, so he doesn't leave the field. It's kind of a Brian Branch situation for them, and kind of mirrors how the Lions use St. Brown. And so I just think that's going to be a phenomenal matchup. But Stoney hit the nail on the head. I mean, you've got to run the ball in this game, and I know that's such an old school mentality, but their defensive line is banged up, especially if Leonard Williams doesn't play or isn't 100%. The opportunities are there. They're not a good run defense. I think they're allowing something in the ballpark of 4.6 yards per carry. So, it's a weakness on a very good defense. And so I think that is going to be the key to everything. And Dan Campbell brought up today, they want to win the explosives battle. So
yeah,
I don't think you find the explosives unless the play action game is working for you.
Well, yeah, well, they were destroyed in the explosives battle last time these two teams played in week two of last season. I think Geno alone had, I think, 11 explosives that day. I was going through his numbers today. Yeah, he had 11 explosive passes in that game last year. And if they give him close to that again, I don't know if they can win. This is not an easy defense to have those kind of plays against. I did like that, you know, we saw a little more 12 personnel from the Lions last weekend, and even some jumbo sets 13, in there with Skip, and I would expect some more of that, if only just to help out a little bit of an undermanned offensive line. And yeah, I mean, the Lions offense at its best runs first and then guts you through the air. But I what intrigues me is how does this Lions defense show up this year against Geno Smith, who has completely gutted them in their first two matchups. And I remember last year it was Glover Quinn who took to Twitter and said, "Why do the Lions always make Geno Smith look like a Hall of Famer?" And they have. They have done that. He is 55 of 71 for 648 yards, 4 touchdowns and no picks in his last two games against the Lions. And I thought last year in particular, the Seahawks offense did a really good job of isolating and then exposing linebackers in coverage. Like, their tight ends went crazy in that game, led by Noah Fant. I know it's a different trio this year. AJ Barner is one of the tight ends, the former Michigan tight end. They have a third whose name escapes me, but I don't know if we'll see something similar to that.
Pharaoh Brown is who you're
saying. Pharaoh Brown, there you go. I don't know if we'll see something similar to that attack on Monday. What we definitely will see, judging by the first three games, and we saw this last year, a lot of quick passes. Geno Smith will come out with the ball quickly. He leads the NFL already in completions this season. He's completing like 75% of his passes. He's taking what's there. And the Lions pass for us last year playing these guys had a really hard time getting home, similar to the way they struggled to get after Stafford in week one. Geno was out with the ball so quickly, almost every single time he dropped back. And that's going to require, I think, a little more press coverage from those outside corners and even in the slot, just to eliminate some of those easy throws that are out within a second and a half or 2 seconds of the ball being snapped.
And the receivers that they have. I mean, look, the Lions secondary, Arnold, a rookie. Look, he had, Kupp and Nacua for half a game.
Yeah.
And then you had Godwin and Evans. And then last week, you basically had Harrison and Wilson. All right. Seattle's got three. That's yeah. three's more than two. So that's going to be a lot of tough. And last year, if my memory's correct, and I'll look this up, I don't think Smith and Jigba either played or didn't do much because he was a rookie.
Yeah, he had a very slow
five
start.
Five catches, right. 30 yards, something like that.
Yeah, yeah. So now he's more in tune with what they're doing. I mean, right now their receivers, obviously, Metcalf and Smith and Jigba each have 17 receptions. And Tyler Lockett, who always seems to make that key catch no matter who yeah. they're playing against, he's got yeah. 13, let alone you mentioned Will, Noah Fant, he's got 9. And don't forget it, guys coming out of the backfield. I mean, former Michigan/UCLA player Charbonneau, Zach Charbonnet, has been playing. Yeah. He's got 10 receptions. Now, granted, he's playing for Kenneth Walker a little bit, but he won't be. Kenneth Walker's going to play, so I wouldn't be surprised if they bring Charbonnet in a lot for passing situations.
Mm-hmm. I looked it up while we were chatting here. So Geno's getting the ball out third quickest yeah. in football yeah, behind only
surprising.
Tua and Aaron Rodgers. And Goff's not yeah. much further down, to be honest with you, but that's tracks with all of them, right? Like
yeah.
efficient. You want your ball going to your first read. Smith and Jigba had 12 catches, I think, of those 17 against New England. So it's kind of a situation that we see here where it's a different guy, maybe popping each game. There's just so many things to cover. But what I think we'll probably see in this contest that we have not seen through 3 weeks is a lot more nickel from the Lions. Mm-hmm. I think you have to counter with that. One, because Barnes isn't there.
Yep.
And for all the talk about who replaces Barnes, I think Amik Robertson's going to play a relatively sizable role in that. But if those three receivers are going to be on the field most of the time, you can't counter with Jack Campbell or Ben Neiman yeah. or Malcolm yeah. Rodriguez, because Smith and Jigba will feast. I mean, he'll just eat on you.
Yeah, no doubt. I think the Lions really like the way that Amik Robertson has played through three games. Campbell singled him out this week as playing outstandingly in coverage so far. And I don't know if the metrics back that up, but I think Amik has been pretty sticky in that slot role myself. I mean, he travels across the field well with receivers, and Jigba runs a lot of those intermediate and crossing type routes. I think if they end up matched up between Njigba and Amik, that the Lions can feel good about that. And that's something that they could not say in this matchup last year.
Here's the other thing to feel good about, guys. I mean, yeah, Seattle's 3-0. They're playing really well, and we talk about all their players and things like that. And their defense is good. But let's be honest. They've faced Bo Nix in his first game, Brissett, and Tua didn't play in the third game. So
Skylar Thompson.
Yes. So they
and Tim Boyle.
Yes. And Tim Boyle, yes, right. Who died so multiple times in that game.
So they haven't exactly played, you know, great quarterbacks yet. So maybe that we can put that in our pipe and smoke it in a good way.
I don't know what to do with that statement. No, look, it's been as soft of an NFL schedule as you can face as a defense. There aren't cupcakes in this league, but this is the closest thing to a Texas A&M Tech, whatever. I mean, it's
not very good.
They should be 3-0. They are 3-0. I think the New England game was probably too close for comfort for them. But you know, I haven't looked at the line, but I imagine the Lions are favored in this one. I am curious, how they might look differently offensively. You know, Dan Campbell downplayed it today when I asked, but their offensive coordinator is Ryan Grubb, and his only experience prior to this was college. And I don't think there's a massive gap between the college game and the pro game, but certainly some of the run concepts are a little bit more spaced out, I think, a little bit more spread based. And Campbell said they're doing, you know, some quirky things with the no huddle offense. But I'm always fascinated when you get kind of somebody out of the good old boys network and you go outside of that and find a fresh face. And so I'm curious to see what Grubb is bringing offensively to this matchup.
Well, the game opened the Lions as a 6-point favorite. It's been bet down, or injuries had something to do with it. It's at 3.5 right now.
Well, that's a big
swing.
And yeah. I don't know a lot about gambling, but I certainly know that. What else we got on the Seattle matchup, boys? Anything
you
else?
Know, I not specific to this matchup, but I just want to point out that through three games, this Lions defense looks like a legitimate strength, and they are doing that through three games without some players that we thought were going to play huge roles. I mean, they had maybe their best defensive performance in 3 years, and maybe in Aaron Glenn's tenure last week, without their most essential defensive player in Alex Anzalone. And they did it while losing McNeil and Davenport in that game, even though he did play and branch for a little bit. It's really impressive to me that they can enter games now and not have to score 25 plus to win. It changes the ceiling and the outlook for this team. And the defense has talked a lot about wanting to change that narrative, that this isn't just an offensively driven team, and they're beginning to do that. I mean, if I had told any of you guys that they were going to get shut out in the second half against the Cardinals, you would have said they're coming home 1-2. But
right,
the defense found a way to step up, and they just have playmakers now at every level of the defense, and that's a huge difference from seasons past. I think they've taken it upon themselves, and Hutchinson was saying this, in fact, back in week one, that we want to be known as a team that can anchor on its defense when times get tough. Well, times got tough last week for the offense, and the defense carried the day. I entered the season thinking, if this is even a league average defense, this team has a legitimate chance to win a Super Bowl. And man, they look like they might be better than that. This could truly be a top 10 defense. And that to me makes the Lions as likely as anyone to come out of the NFC.
You know, I think the weakness for Seattle, and I haven't looked at the numbers yet, but is their offensive line as far as run. I mean, you know, Walker, yes, he hadn't played, but you know, last week, but he's missed two games. So the game he played, he had 5.5 yards a carry approximately. But other than that, they're averaging over just under 4 yards a carry. You mentioned Martin Mayhew before, Justin. I mean, hey, one of his great picks, Laken Tomlinson, is coming back home.
Year 10 for that man.
Yeah.
I know.
Ron Prince tried to break him.
That's right.
Did not succeed.
They'll have the tribute video right before they honor Calvin Johnson, right? So it's going to be imperative that the Lions, you know, I think if Seattle's smart, you mentioned their, you know, new offensive coordinator, they're going to pass the ball a lot, because the Lions' strength, we talked about how good their secondary's been and, you know, how they've improved, but their run defense has been phenomenal.
Yep.
And Seattle doesn't run the ball that well, so I think it's going to be a Seattle air show, at least they hope it will be.
All right, save it for the pick, Stoney. Save it for the pick.
Okay.
So Will brought it up earlier, a lot of 12 personnel, a lot of 13 personnel, a lot of tight ends on the field, and we're going to count Dan Skipper in that. But, you know, we are trying to add an interview to this podcast each week. And so today we tracked down one of those tight ends, and wasn't Sam LaPorta, and it wasn't Brock Wright. We went deep with tight end / fullback Parker Hesse. And we will be back from break with that interview in just a moment. All right, Will and I hit the locker room today looking for a victim, if you will. And we found one in the furthest corner of the locker room in tight end / fullback Parker Hesse. Here's that interview now.
Parker, I looked at your high school bio. Four sports you lettered in, is that correct?
Yeah.
So
I'm from a small school. So
how small we talk? Are we talking a couple hundred?
In the whole school, I was 85 in my class. It's around 400 in the high school. So it averages about 100 a class. My class was small.
So they needed somebody on all the teams, and you just
An opportunity to play every sport you got. So yeah.
So tell me about the different things you played. Give me the baseball position. Give me the basketball. You know, what would you do on the basketball court, and then track and field? What was your events?
In baseball, I played third base pretty much my whole career. Basketball, majority of the time I brought the ball up the floor. It was like the one or two guard, sometimes. And track, I was like twos and fours mostly.
Meters.
Yeah, 200 and 400 meters, and then relays with those types of races, yeah.
Quite. Hadn't filled out the body enough to be doing shot put and discus?
We had a guy in my high school who won the discus in a second in the shot, so I wasn't winning the job in high school.
Were there any sports that you didn't play in high school?
I mean, in terms of stuff that's, I wrestled in like peewee and junior high, but basketball is way more fun, so I did that in high school. In terms of others, we have like golf and soccer. I wondered about that. So,
not enough contact. football, 11 man at your high school?
Yeah.
Yep. And you played, it feels like, all the positions. You were the QB, little running back, little wide receiver, little defense. Like, where did you play the most, I guess, for your high school team?
Senior year, I played quarterback exclusively on offense. Growing up, I was a quarterback. So my sophomore and junior year, I kind of moved around a little bit where I played receiver, and then we had a running back go down, so I played running back a lot my junior year. But still some quarterback stuff. But, yeah, my senior year, I was the quarterback, and I played outside linebacker on defense.
Was the dream to play quarterback in college in the pros? And did you have to switch that dream to being a
linebacker? It was a lot of fun, but I kind of realized my junior year that probably wasn't in the cards for me, or at least I'd have a lot more opportunities being a position player than a quarterback. Yeah.
How did you come to that realization? Is it something that someone told you, or did you just have a come to Jesus moment yourself and decide I'm probably more of a defensive player?
Well, just like when you start getting interest from colleges, it was like, they would kind of, there was just more interest as a defensive player. No one was saying like, hey man, we want you to play quarterback.
The Iowa dream for Iowa high schoolers is to play for the University of Iowa. I mean, we find that's pretty universally true.
Yeah, we don't have a pro team, so yeah. I mean, everyone grows up, the Hawks are the biggest show in town, kind of. So
I was stalking your 24/7 recruiting page. It seemed like you had offers from Iowa, Iowa State, Northern Iowa, and I think maybe South Dakota State and Western Illinois. Was there any doubt you were ever going to end up at Iowa?
I mean, no. Not once Iowa offered me, I was going there. But yeah, the rest of my offers were that Missouri Valley Conference. Mm-hmm. So
you didn't try to convince Coach Ferentz to let you take a few snaps just to see how it'd work out?
No. No.
So moved to defense permanently, I guess, at Iowa. Have some success, but get to the pros, and once again, they jerk you around and move you to a different position. So how difficult was the transition from tight end? We've seen it here before. Matt Nelson came defense.
Played right next to me, yeah.
Yeah, so how difficult was that transition for you?
There were a lot of things that were different. Obviously, just process and play calls. You go from a college defense where, they give two signals, and then you all the adjustments are formations once your offense breaks the huddle. So hearing a play call that, in the NFL is 12, 13 words long, and as a tight end, a lot of it applies to you.
Yeah.
So that was, tough. That was a learning experience. And obviously running routes, just standing up and running after playing D-line, that's not something that, I've been doing a whole lot of the previous 4 years. So, and obviously that's something that I still, got to put a lot of attention to.
So do you feel responsible for upholding the tight end U standard, even though you didn't actually play tight end at tight end U?
No, I feel like I now get to tag along on their, the brand that they've built. I could coattail on that reputation. So
does George even invite you yet? Or do you still need another year or two under your belt before you get invited to Nashville?
I have been invited. Yeah. Okay. But obviously, you don't get a lot of time off in the summer, so it's kind of, it's hard to take time off being home. So
for sure. You've been doing a lot of the fullback stuff here. How much does that kind of appeal to your past as a linebacker, as a defensive lineman, just that full-on contact element of the position?
Obviously, playing defense, you got to be physical. You got to be able to defeat blocks and tackle. So I think that translates to in the run game. But there's a lot of different techniques, even to playing fullback, that are different that, I've had to learn and got to continue to learn, different blocks. Just because you're in different positions when you're, the way you approach a block, the way you strike someone, the way you, restart your feet. So that's something that, it's kind of, there's not a whole lot of carry over, and something that takes reps to learn.
It's such an involved position. I mean, you just described it. There's so many responsibilities that go with it, and rarely do you see rookies come in and thrive in the NFL as tight ends. To know that Sam did last year, just what stood out to you most about what he was able to achieve in his first NFL season?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I wasn't up here last year, so I didn't get to see it firsthand, but yeah, I mean, just the way he plays the game confidently, and he's out there to make plays, and that's something that, especially as a young player, it's hard. You're kind of overthinking things. There's a lot on your plate, and just to watch him on tape, to see him get out there, cut it loose, and just play football how it's supposed to be played, is what I think is most impressive, or what I admire.
You filled your entire high school existence with playing every sport imaginable, as we talked about. What interest do you have outside of sports?
Right now I got a 2-year-old daughter, so I spend a lot of time playing with her. But yeah, I mean, just hanging with friends, cooking, doing outdoor stuff, hunting, fishing. That's kind of what I enjoy the most, playing pickleball.
Who's more Iowa, you or Jack Campbell?
No one's more Iowa than Jack Campbell. So,
all right, I like to ask this one. Guy says they like to cook, because I also like to cook. What's the signature dish? If you got friends coming over, what's your go-to?
Like friends coming over, what time of year? I mean,
we have seasonal menus in the Hesse household. How about football season?
Like in the fall, I would say like a couple beer can chickens.
Yes.
Is a dish I feel pretty confident in. Whatever you want for a side, potato dish, parsley potatoes, something like that. Or in the summer, you got some good tomatoes, try to make a sauce maybe, and some pasta.
Yeah.
Dead of winter, just a good chili, grilled cheese.
You're hitting all the right notes, man.
Hey, making me hungry just standing here.
Summer, you got burgers or steak with some chimichurri, maybe.
You make your own chimichurri.
I've done it before, and it's turned out well, so it's kind of something that I'm looking to continue doing,
I know you're pretty new to the area, but have you found any good fishing, hunting spots yet? Has Jack directed you in the right places to go?
Not really. I mean, there's just not a lot of free time, and you kind of got to be someone who's in the area for a long time to find private landowners who are willing to let you out. I'm not always outgoing enough to find people like that.
We've put you on the spot here then, but certainly Jack and Frank can steer you in the right spot. You might be able to get a guest spot on Grizzly Man Outdoors.
If you were asked to pass rush in a pinch in an NFL game, what would be your go-to move? Are you a spin move guy? Were you a speed to power guy? If you had to go pass rush tomorrow in a game, what's the first move that you're going to?
Absolutely speed to power. If I had enough bend to do anything else, I probably would have pursued that as my NFL position. But just get a good get off and then go to a long run. So,
Parker, this was fun. It was enlightening. I think people enjoy getting a chance to know you a little bit more, so we appreciate you taking a little bit of the time.
Yeah, appreciate you guys.
And I demand some beer can chicken as soon as possible.
Okay, we'll get that done. I'll have my little stand out here. You put the can in it, so I'll have my wife bring that out when she comes again.
Well, I'll chip in. Appreciate you, man.
Thank you. Appreciate it, man.
I don't know about you guys. I love the back of the roster interviews, and man, Will netted us the quote of the day. There is nobody as Iowa as Jack Campbell, and I wholeheartedly agree.
I think all of Iowa would agree.
So before we call it a show, we'll do our thing here with predictions, and I believe you said 3.5, Stoney, is that correct?
Yes, indeed.
All right, what are you doing with those 3.5 points?
Well, it's interesting. I'm looking at some trends here, guys. Seattle 5-0 against the spread the last five games when playing the Lions. 5-0 straight up in those games, as you know. The Lions 5-1 straight up in its last six home games. 4-1 against the spread in its last five. I went with the Cardinals last week and was wrong. I'm going to go with the Lions this week. I think the place is just going to be unbelievable. Black jerseys, people going crazy. I just think this is going to be, I don't think it's going to be as high scoring as their other games. Their games have been outrageously high scoring. So I'm going to say something like, 27-21 Lions.
All right.
I like that. Sony, you mentioned the opposing quarterbacks that the Seahawks have faced they haven't faced a quarterback who can run like Jared Goff, the new mobile quarterback in the NFL. And he even said today, he said, I've been working on that. I'm good for one a game. And he has been for three games, one key rushing first down per game. I think Jared Goff adds to his rushing totals on Monday night with another key first down on another late fourth quarter drive. I'll take the Lions to win this game by a late touchdown and cover. I got the Lions and their mobile quarterback, Jared Goff, to win on Monday Night Football.
Bonus prop bet action from Bill.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, rushing yards, 7.5, over under.
You know, it's weird. You'd think at this point I'd be adjusted, but like it's weird covering a team that you expect to win most games, and that's really where it's at. And I don't know for sure, but I think I've picked the Lions to cover both the first two games. We obviously didn't pick week one because we weren't up and running yet, but I probably would have picked them for the Rams game as well. And look, I understand Seattle has their number. I do, and I don't think there's any mystery or mystique to it. I just think it's kind of coincidental. That's what happens when you play well-coached teams. They know how to win close games, and I don't know. I think the Pete Carroll effect might be an impact here. It looks like Mike McDonald's a really good coach, but
he doesn't chew gum like Pete Carroll, though.
No one does. No one chews gum like the great Pete Carroll.
What did Aiden call Mike McDonald today?
He called him a little liar. He said, you know, I got to reach out to Coach McDonald. I loved having him at Michigan. He said he made football fun for him again, but he said, I got to text him and give him some shit because, you know, he told me back at Michigan that, you know, he never really wanted to become a head coach. And then I saw him take that job this offseason and I said, you little liar. So Mike McDonald, for the first time in his career, has been dubbed the little liar.
Pretty little liars.
We'll take Aiden Hutchinson in the vengeance game against the little liar. I don't think Seattle's getting in the end zone three times, but maybe. So I'll go... Oh, I don't know. I'll just take a point off of each of Sony's holes and go 26-20. I like those. I like that 6-point spread. Sony did bring it up. Black jersey debut. I imagine the Lions have some things ready to roll out. I would be pretty disappointed if there's no Metallica in that mix. not a huge Metallica guy, but come on.
Or for the old farts like me, a little Paint It Black by the Rolling Stones.
Sure, let's just get a whole mix of songs in there. A little Slayer, a little Rolling Stone.
Paint the end zones black, baby. Let's just go all out. Uprights. Let's go black lines across the field. Just black turf. Just Boise State, but black it out.
Black lights. Yeah. I think it's going to be awesome. I think this stadium has been getting wild with these primetime games. I think this is just going to add that little extra half degree on the volume knob. I'm looking forward to it. I thought I would dislike the black jerseys because...
I didn't like them the first time they came out. I really didn't.
Yeah, so. But I like the black on black. I like the black pants, the black jersey.
And those helmets look great with the black.
Yeah, I think it's all going to come together really nicely. And right.
They're not wearing these.
You might be there on the press box.
Oh yeah,
that is one. They should bring that back as the fourth alternative next year. All right, this episode, as always, was produced by Zach Clark. He is our godsend. Helps us out every week. You can listen to this podcast for free on the Odyssey app. You can get it on Apple Podcasts. You can get it on Spotify. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts. So please subscribe, rate them. Will lives on those little stars you give us. So those are super meaningful. And then you can follow Will's work on 971theticket.com. And you can follow me and my work on the Detroit Football Network, which is at detroitfootball.net.
And you can listen to the post-game show with myself and Jennifer Hammond on 97 on the Ticket right after the game. And then after that, me and J-Rodge get together till, 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah,
hey,
I was just
Matt
gonna ask.
Stoney chooses to flake at the last minute like he did last weekend.
Well, that wasn't my fault. That was a miscommunication from about three different people. But yeah.
Hey, we'll watch the tape and clean it up.
Will you pop it on at 3 a.m. with us?
Yeah. You'll probably be there.
I'll probably still be awake. Yeah, I might be a few beers deep at that point. But yeah, I wouldn't mind hopping on.
Come on, perfect. It's gonna be the appetizer to the playoff game starting the next day in Houston.
I love that our sign-off is here. Our sign-off is always our longest segment. It's perfect.
I know.
All right, folks. Thanks for listening.